Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Historically, when we've had very high marginal rates, we get 17.6, 18.2% of GDP in taxes.
It's Arizona Republican Representative David Schweikert.
When we've had very low marginal rates, we get 17.6, 18.2% of the economy in taxes because the economy changes in growth. So when you look at it, the black line is receipts, revenue. The line above it is interest and health care. So when our friends keep saying, well, we're going to tax the rich more, great, but I've already shown you if every tax worked absolutely to its maximum efficiency, you get 1.5% of GDP, and we're borrowing 7% this year.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
There are a few pundits that have taken the last few months to spread misinformation about this committee's bipartisan product in an attempt to sow division.
Chairman of the House Ag Committee, G.T. Thompson from Pennsylvania.
Let me be clear. This is a farm bill that provides significant improvement for all producers. The legislation was drafted under the principle that we would deliver what America's producers need, no more and certainly no less. As a result, it looks different from state to state and from farm to farm. The policy changes this committee made were targeted to provide the greatest return on investment possible so that all producers will be better off. The bill passed out of this committee is an investment in the future, not a venue for empty relitigating of fights from the past. But if folks do want to discuss the past, here are the facts. The 2002 Farm Bill was the last Farm Bill to invest in the commodity programs. The Democrat-led 2008 Farm Bill, not this current committee, cut money out of the crop insurance while investing in a conservation and nutrition programs. Because of a deficit reduction exercise, the 2014 Farm Bill saw commodity programs cut by over 30%, while conservation and nutrition were left relatively unscathed. Finally, since the enactment of the 2018 Farm Bill, Democrats in Congress unilaterally added billions to climate and conservation programs, and the current administration added $0.25 trillion to the nutrition programs, all while ignoring the farm safety net. The romanticized Farm Bill coalition, often talked about, is one-sided, partisan talking point. Producers are constantly reminded of hundreds of billions of dollars of SNAP and climate spending and reprimanded when they seek any level of parity. Now, I would not apologize for advancing a bill that seeks to put the farm back in the Farm Bill. I also won't apologize for advancing a bill that was written by every member of this committee. 40 provisions that were put into this that were just led by my Democratic colleagues and friends. And I don't put things in legislation just to kind of buy a vote. I put it in there because it was great legislation. It helped to put the farm back in the Farm Bill. 140 provisions that were led in a bipartisan way, at least one Democrat, one Republican. So a strong bipartisan bill that puts the farm back in the Farm Bill. Now, I'm tired of the politics and the gamesmanship, and I know folks out in the countryside are too. Unfortunately, through this process, I've been saddled with a meddling Senate Democrat and others who do not seem to appreciate the dire circumstances in farm country. As recently as last week, House Ag Committee Democrats expressed a preference to see a bill fail before engaging. So I will try to say this again. If there are members on the other side of the aisle who truly want to see a farm bill come to fruition this year, my door remains open to renegotiation from any partner willing to come to the table with a serious proposal and not more red lines. For those who believe that the only path forward with the time we have remaining in this Congress is an informal pre-conference negotiation with the Senate, that is not my preferred option. But it is one I'm willing to entertain. However, I cannot reconcile or nor negotiate a bipartisan 900-page bill with a partisan 90-page summary. For that to be viable, Chairwoman Stabenow needs to unveil her bill text. I hope that after listening to our guest today, everyone in this room and watching across the country will understand the urgency by which we must act. For the first time in a long time, this committee has a chance to be proactive instead of reactive to prevent disaster for our producers rather than picking up the pieces afterwards with ineffective and inefficient ad hoc support and to establish a foundation for the future of the farm economy. Let's not waste that opportunity.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Once again, I can make this math work, but you don't pretend we can tax rich people. We can just cut our way there. You may have to do a bit of both of those, but it's policy.
Arizona Representative David Schweikert.
I've done presentation after presentation after presentation on how you could crash healthcare, how you could adopt artificial intelligence to reduce the size of this government dramatically and still have better customer service, how the mechanics of talent-based immigration could actually grow the economy, but shutting down the border, stopping importing competition to our working poor, making our working poor poor. But you got to think like an economist, and the idiot, the folks here want to make talk down to you, talk to you like you're a child, and say, well, if we just did this, we'd be fine. It doesn't work that way. We are now so upside down debt-wise that unless you do something it's holistic with lots of moving parts, none of the math works. And we're uncomfortable telling that truth. So let's actually walk through a board I don't think I've ever shown before. Fiscal year 2024. Here's sort of what where we're at to date. We've taken in $3,755 billion. Do you see the red here? Okay, the red is the individual income tax. Your country is an income tax-based economic system, where other countries may rely more on a value-added tax, which is a really regressive tax, crushes particularly the middle class. The blue over here, when you start to look at that, this is functionally, we call it social insurance and retirement programs and Social Security. Well, that's actually going out the door immediately, and we have to borrow some to cover it. The blue over here, well, that's actually corporate income taxes. Remember the United States back in about the late 80s, early 90s, we changed much of our corporate tax structure when we started having pass-throughs. Do you remember LLCs, subchapter S's, partnerships, those things? So much of what is corporate activity in the United States flows through to that individual tax line. So when you get the brain trust here, it says, we're just going to raise corporate taxes. Great. Okay. And that's going to solve something? Remember, and we're trying to vet the paper I got the math from, but we have a paper from about a year and a half ago that said in the 2017 tax reform we did, 67% of the corporate tax rate reduction went to wages. So when you have someone from the left who runs around here saying, we're going to raise corporate taxes, ta-da, what they're doing is basically screwing over the working men and women of the country. That's how it works. When your wages go up, the old saying used to be it's inflation. Well, that doesn't get you anything. Or it's productivity. Because you built a tax code that said we can afford to buy the next better piece of equipment. We can build better processes. We can build better supply chains. We're becoming more productive. And you as a worker get part of that. But part of that productivity also is a tax system that maximizes economic vitality. Economic growth is moral. If you want to have fewer poor people in your society, if you want to close income equality, you do it not through transfer payments. We have data over data over data that many of the transfer payments at the end of the decade make people poorer because you disassociate them, their lives from being part of the society, part of work. So the secret is have an economy that grows, that needs them. It's getting economics right is moral.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We've had a few years of drought in a row, and some places of Kansas still haven't had a whole lot of rain. And so producers might be looking to purchase hay from different parts of the state than they normally do, or even from out of state, to be able to fill those forage resource needs that they have for the upcoming winter feeding season.
Kansas State University beef cattle nutritionist, Philip Lancaster.
If they're in a situation where they only forage they were able to put up with some pretty low quality forage, and so they might look elsewhere to purchase some higher quality forage for specific classes of cattle. So particularly if I have fall calving cows that are going to be lactating through the winter, I would want a higher quality forage for those cows, and so I might need to look elsewhere to find a higher quality forage than what I was able to put up this year. The biggest question when it comes to purchasing hay is, am I getting a good quality product? And so there's several different things that we can do to evaluate that. One is get your eyes on the forage. Go visit the farm and take a look at the hay itself and evaluate leaf-to-stem ratio. So as forages grow and mature, and when they go from a what we call a vegetative state where there's no stems and seed heads to a reproductive state where there are stems and seed heads, the digestibility of that forage goes down considerably. And so the highest quality forage is going to be when there's no stems and seed heads present, and then the lowest quality is going to be when there's a very high proportion of stems and seed heads present and very few leaves. And so it's hard to make that guess on how that really affects digestibility because different forage species are different. So, for instance, at the same stage of maturity or the same stem to leaf ratio, brumgrass is going to be higher digestibility than native prairie hay. And so there's going to be differences there among species, and even with other species, just those two. And so we need to also ask for a forage test. So on the forage test, key things that I want to know protein, and that's a good indicator of quality, but I also want to look at NDF and ADF. Those are measures of the amount of fiber in that plant, and as that plant matures, the amount of fiber increases, and particularly ADF. And so high amounts of ADF will reduce digestibility of that forage. Some other things to think about from that analysis is that I want to have some way to compare that to a standard. So we use things like relative feed value. And so knowing that standard to see where that hay ranks and what's considered normal and good quality. And so there are some extension publications you can find that will help you understand relative feed value. And the other thing is knowing how the producer took the samples that he sent for analysis. Did he just take them off the first cutting? Did he just take them from bales around the outside of the haystack? Or did he actually take a core, what we call a hay probe, and did he go into those bales and do several bales in the stack that you're going to buy so that you have a good representative sample of what's there?
K-State's Philip Lancaster. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Each year, members of Congress take time during the month of August to return to their home districts and hear directly from constituents.
And that's why the House and Senate are not in session during this month. Chad Smith has more.
Cody Lyon, Managing Director of Advocacy and Political Affairs for the American Farm Bureau Federation, says the August recess is an important time in the political process.
August recess is a phrase used for congressional members to come back to the district or the state, spend time with their constituents, spend time interacting with different groups within their district, and kind of learn what is it those constituents want, what problems they're having, carry on a variety of different policy conversations so that they can address their big concerns.
He says it's very important for Farm Bureau members to take advantage of the face-to-face opportunity to interact with policymakers who will directly impact agriculture.
The face-to-face meeting of a constituent or farmer and rancher with their member of Congress is easily the most influential advocacy tactic anybody can do. And the reason is there's this interaction. There's the ability to ask a question, get an answer, have a follow-up, do something that you can show the member of Congress what's happening on a farm or ranch. And there's nothing like showing.
He talks about some of the key issues that farmers and ranchers need to engage on.
What we're asking our state farm bureaus and farm bureau members to do is, first, we know the election is coming up. Learning where your members of Congress and or other candidates stand on your key issues is vitally important. Second, Farm Bill continues to be a key issue. It's been a key issue for us going forward. And finally, tax reform. Several provisions in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act will expire next year. This period right now is for education and for members of Congress who may not have been around in 2017.
Farmland prices keep climbing, according to USDA's Land Values Report. Danny Munch, an economist with the American Farm Bureau Federation, talks about what farmers are facing.
The Department of Agriculture's Land Values Report shows that agricultural real estate values are up 5%, or an average of $200 an acre, to a record of $4,170 an acre over 2023. This includes cropland being up 4.7% to $5,570 an acre, and pastureland being up 5.2% to $1,830 an acre over last year. How much farmers are paying for rent for cropland has also reached record levels, with cash rent up 3.2% over last year.
Munch says land values and cash rents are two key indicators used to measure the health of the farm economy.
There's two sides of the story here, the first being that land values continue to increase, which means land, which is farmers' number one asset, has increased in value. This puts farmers in a stronger financial position when it comes to acquiring loans. When land values increases start to slow, though, like we're seeing, the equity growth starts to slow as well. So banks might consider farmers higher risk if their asset value is stagnating. On the cash rent side, higher cash rent is just another negative on the balance sheet. So seeing record levels here means breaking even is even harder.
He says the value of ag land is something to keep an eye on moving forward.
Ag land values have increased over the past year, which is a positive short-run sign for farmers looking to acquire loans, but a hurdle to those who rent land. If production expenses and those costs associated with them start to outpace the growth in land values, especially if this happens as crop prices fall, this could be problematic for farmers' abilities to pay for inputs and make any form of profit.
For more information, visit the Market Intel page at fb.org. Chad Smith, Washington.
Thanks, Chad. You're listening to our comprehensive look at agribusiness news, markets, and weather. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Who really runs this government?
Arizona Representative David Schweiker.
Seriously, it's an honest question. I need you to think like adults. Maybe those who actually went to a finance class. Who actually now runs this government? I'm going to argue the debt markets, the bond markets from around the world. If you have to bring almost $10 trillion to market this fiscal year, two and a quarter trillion virgin new issues because we're borrowing, that's like $75,000 to $80,000 a second right now, and the economy is good, the actual baseline data on GDP is good, and you're still burning almost $80,000 a second in borrowing, what happens the second you have a U.S. debt auction that's undersubscribed, or there's not enough people there? What happens to U.S. interest rates? How much of the world goes into depression? But we're going to talk about that, right? Oh, God, no, no. No, because that would require math. That would require being serious. You know, we passed a bill here earlier today. I voted no on it. And look, they worked hard on it. They lowered the top-line spending. But you got to deal with a really uncomfortable discussion. Every dime a member of Congress votes on is borrowed. Okay, let's process that. Every dime a member of Congress votes on is borrowed, and depending on some of the projections, about a quarter of Medicare. Social Security has its own trust fund. It runs out in like 9-10 years, and then we got to figure out what's going to happen there, and we can continue to get Democrats coming behind the microphone and lying about it, which makes it almost impossible to actually lay out the math and try to fix it. And remember, raising the cap, doing the Democrats' plan of $400,000 up and just raising the cap only covers about 38% of the shortfall. You had the president in that debate last month saying, if we just tax rich people 1% more. And I have a chart in here that will show it's a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of the shortfall. Remember, if you take $400,000 and up, the Democrats' definition of rich, and you tax them at 12.4%, you only cover 38% of the shortfall. So 1%. And this is the nature of our discussion. When every dime a member of Congress votes on is borrowed, is it moral to borrow money here to send it to entities around the country, even though their programs, many of them I love. I think they're the right thing. I just think the way we finance it isn't. Is it right to send them cash to that city, to that state, to that county, and they have their own taxing authority? They may have more cash in the bank than we do as a percentage. Do you borrow money? Because that's what we're doing today. We're borrowing money. And the crazy thing, when you do the adjustment for the ability for interest to be tax exempt from municipal debt, we have municipalities in this country that have a better credit rating, than the United States. Remember, Greece can sell a 10-year bond cheaper than the United States today. We are number 14 on the credit stack, meaning there's 13 other countries that can sell a 10-year bond cheaper than the United States. And if you read the instruments, if you read the Moody's, the S&Ps, their documents and their reps and warrants and their analysis on U.S. debt, they don't trust this place. They do not believe Congress, particularly, because it's our job. We're supposed to be the adults in the room. We make policy. The White House carries it out. And they don't trust us.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We're still getting smaller.
Dr. Darrell Peel is an Oklahoma State livestock economist answering the question of whether we're starting to rebuild the herd.
Actually, as an industry, we started this year with the lowest cattle numbers in decades. The indications are that the herd has gotten smaller this year. We're looking for signs of, you know, there's two things that'll happen when we start herd rebuilding. One will be heifer retention. That's the big one that we're looking for. The other one is that cow culling will reduce to minimal levels as producers try to hang on to cows a little bit longer than usual. Cow slaughter is down about 16% this year. But if you look at it in the context of the broader set of numbers, that's probably not enough to indicate that we are actually in the process of herd rebuilding. That's still going to give us a culling rate of 10 to 11%. It'll probably drop down around 9% when we start rebuilding the herd. July 1 Cattle on Feed report also included a breakdown of steers and heifers in feedlots. And those numbers indicated that we still have right at 40% of all the feedlot inventory is heifers. So we continue to place heifers in the feedlot. We're not keeping them out in the country, apparently, at this point. And so that's a process that has yet to get started.
So, again, doesn't look like we're rebuilding the herd. But what will have to happen for us to do just that?
Well, there's a couple things that are going to have to happen. One is, obviously, when can we do it? So that's a question, really, of the drought situation. I think, by and large, we've had better forage conditions this year, and some folks can do it and probably are doing it to a limited degree. But there are concerns going forward about reemerging drought, and particularly with the idea of La Nina rebuilding in the U.S., that's a concern for later this year and on into next year. So that may be holding folks back a little bit. The other part of it is just producer expectations, which is a function of the financial situation, the cost of financing herd rebuilding, and just producer expectations for these markets. They're enjoying these high markets right now, but the question is, how long will they last? Will they last long enough to make it worth that investment in those heifers for future production? Apparently, producers don't believe we're there yet, so they have not started that process.
And with tighter supplies, you'd expect a reduction in production.
We came into the year expecting beef production to be down 4 to 4.5%. It's not going to be down that much because in the first half of the year, slaughter was down modestly for steers and heifers, 1.5% or so. But again, we still got a lot of heifers on feed, so we're still slaughtering quite a lot of heifers. But carcass weights have increased dramatically this year, so fed beef production, which is about 84% of total beef production, is actually up slightly through the first half of the year. Now, the non-fed beef, the cow slaughter part of that, is way down. It's down about 13%. But the point is, as we go forward, we'll probably see a bit more decrease in beef production, but we're going to end the year more like a 3% year-over-year decrease in beef production compared to the earlier estimates of 4 to 5%. So, you know, we're still on track. Obviously, we've had strong prices. We've set new record prices for cattle so far this year. taking a little bit of a break here in the summer,
yeah,
kind of through the summer doldrums, but the markets are still on track to continue generally moving higher as we go forward.
Oklahoma State livestock economist Dr. Darrell Peel. I'm Tony St. James. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Ag impacts associated with what was Hurricane Debby? USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says several areas in its path caught a break in that.
Initially, from an agricultural standpoint, Debby moved through about the best possible area you could take a hurricane through the southeastern United States.
Meaning a path from Florida's Big Bend through southeastern Georgia cut between major ag regions.
So, for example, we saw very limited impacts in Florida's citrus areas, Florida sugarcane, and we also bypassed a lot of Georgia's major southwestern production areas for crops like peanuts and cotton.
However, as Debbie's remnants travel out to sea and intensify before making landfall in South Carolina later this week, threats to agriculture include flooding that could impact major row crops in the Carolinas and Virginia and North Carolina hog and pig farms. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.